But in a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Of course there's nothing like having your own theme song. Hey, everybody, this is John Kess and Jeff Carlin, Chicago Way. What's up, Jeff?
Hey, John.
So, okay, this business of morons who have money, these one percenters going on vacation while I'm sitting there playing an old Call of Duty in my basement because I don't want to buy a new one. And they're going to these sunny spa resort places like Cabos or wherever cool, really cool radio personalities go. And they find little dolphins on the beach and they pass them around until the dolphins die?
Yeah.
What's going on with that?
I don't understand, John. There's a couple of incidents. There's a small dolphin was picked out of the shallow waters on a beach and taken so people could pet it and take photos with it, and the damn thing died. And I think that's atrocious.
Okay, watch yourself, mister, the damn thing.
Well, okay? I'm sorry, the poor thing.
I don't know if they have souls, what? Dolphins. Not cats, but poor thing.
Poor thing.
Right?
Poor thing.
Poor little dolphin. Faster than lightning.
John, I can do a dolphin impersonation.
Do it while I'm singing Flipper?
While you're singing Flipper.
Okay, we'll just... Okay. Very, very good, right. Flipper. Hey, Flipper.
Thank you. I tried
it. Hey, Captain Rick.
It didn't... And
the smugglers are over there in the cove.
Yeah. What if Lassie and Flipper teamed up? Was there ever a crossover?
Be superheroes. Like, that would have been amazing. Like a Marvel Comics.
That's what we need next.
But okay, why would you want to pet a dolphin and kill a dolphin so you could take a selfie? What a moron!
I know people don't understand. The same thing with sharks. There was a guy just recently too that pulled a small shark out of the water to take photos with it and pet it, and people were taking pictures, and it died too.
What kind of shark?
I didn't see what kind of shark, but a small one. I mean, it wasn't a.
Like a 3-footer?
Yeah, like a 3-footer. I mean, something you could pull out of the water and not worry about.
If it was brown with black tips, I would say kill it immediately.
Why?
And then cut it into steaks, because there's nothing like black tip shark steaks, baby.
Come on. Sharks are the best. Sharks are my favorite animal, John.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you ever see one in the wild?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen one in the wild.
We're on a honeymoon, and Betty decides to cut her leg open on a coral.
Oh.
Okay? Not really. Well, it didn't cut. She just nicked it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of blood in the water. And we're like 2 miles out or a mile out. And now she's bleeding in the water. And I'm in, like, you know, Virgin Gorda, which is like the Caribbean land of sharks and barracudas.
Sure.
And so I just felt like just swimming away as fast as I could. And here, you know.
With Betty or without Betty?
Without her, because she was bleeding.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Come on.
Survival of the fittest.
But I swam behind her in the blood wake.
You're a good man, John.
I'm just such a little wimp. I should have ran. I love you, honey. I just love you so much. Okay. So, all right. So she wants me to shovel, and I'm waiting. I just decided to wait.
So two rules we've established so far in the podcast. Yeah. If it's going to be sunny, or if it's going to be 60 degrees within 48 hours, we call it 48 hours.
Don't even shovel.
Don't even
shovel.
And if you come across wild animals in the water, leave them in the water unless you're going to eat them immediately.
All right, everybody, if you're listening to this, turn off your, your wild animal show because how many times can you watch the hyena and the lion fight? But fill up a glass, take boiling water, boil some water, look out the window, listening to Jeff Carlin do his like little Flipper imitation. And then you put a tablespoon of brown sugar in the bottom of a mug, and then put a cinnamon stick in there, and then take a little tiny bit of lemon zest, just a little bit, not a lot, like a little pinch. And did I say butter?
Mm-mm.
Put some butter in there. Pour rum in there, dark rum.
Spiced rum.
A good dark rum, like a good, 2-3 fingers full.
Sure.
and add some boiling water to that. And there you go with your hot buttered rum. It is perfect to look out at the snow as it's melting and as we get ready for the great sports seasons to come.
And Super Tuesday.
Super Tuesday. We're going to have Tom Bevin on the show from Real Clear Politics to talk about politics. And this guy is just a very smart fellow, and he's the publisher of Real Clear, and I'm sure a lot of you go to it. And so we're going to have him.
We'll talk to him. Before we get to that, John, Kanye West, I have to ask you about Kanye West. How do you feel about Kanye West?
I saw him on, first of all, I saw him on Saturday Night Live for about 3 minutes.
Probably 2 minutes too long.
And he can't even sing. I mean, really, come on. He's singing. There's some sort of styling going on where he's
auto-tune.
Mugging. And he's, what's that called?
Auto-tune.
What is that?
It's a software, essentially, that processes your voice and moves it within to a pitch range. So if you sing, like, if we were very low and we wanted to go high, we would process it, and it would automatically tune our voices up. And it would change the pitch.
15 tons, exactly. And what do you get?
Yeah.
Another day older and deeper in debt. Like that?
Exactly.
And then you can make me sound like Kanye West. Like, wah, 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 wah. All right?
Exactly.
All right. So I see him, and his pants are falling off. I'm thinking, that's so 90s, dude. You know, with the, is it retro now? Retro again on the pants falling off thing?
In some circles, I don't think that's ever gone away.
Put your damn pants on, man. So anyway,
this is the guy who said he's 50% more influential than Stanley Kubrick, Pablo Picasso, Pablo Escobar, and you'll appreciate this, Paul the Apostle. Yeah.
Pardon? Blasphemy! Burn him for a witch. Really? He said that?
Yeah, he said that. He was caught on.
Does he even know who Paul the Apostle is?
I'm assuming.
Or did he hear something?
I mean, I don't think he knows him.
Did he read it off the back of a cereal box? You know, where did he find that?
Could have been. But this, yeah, he was caught on
maybe
mic.
Kim.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah,
Kim.
Yeah, she strikes me as the.
Right? The Kardashian lamb roast.
The Kardashian.
Right? When they had the priest over from in L.A., right?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
That's pathetic, man. I mean, come on. Kanye, no one will know his name next year or the year after. You know what these people are? And they're. It's like white, black, Latino, whatever, pit bull, whatever. It doesn't matter. They're jesters. They mm-hmm. are. You know what they're? Put them in harlequin pants with curly-toed boots, and give them a rattle, and on the end of the rattle is a carved head of their own likeness, and watch them dance up and down, to amuse the people. That's what they do. They're just jesters, and. I've always been happy and glad, and I guess pleased to write about corruption and politics and gangsters because they're real things. If I had to talk to jesters for a living, I'd blow my brains out. I really would. I mean, can you imagine having to talk to court jesters like this?
Eat your soul. I mean.
Right? I mean, you have to set up interviews with these people and. It's just, oh, man, come on.
So John is not a Kanye fan.
I'm not a fan of, did I ever tell you that I stopped listening to popular music in 1976?
I think you've mentioned it, but why?
I was at an Edvard Grieg concert. I was at a Yes concert at the amphitheater, and there's a lot of stuff in the air. There's a lot of smoke in the air. Okay.
Sure.
And people are not, we're in altered consciousnesses. And everyone's flashing their, you know, lighters, their big lighters, or whatever they had. For Yes, and they played Hall on the Mountain King or something, whatever they played. And people are screaming, yeah, dude, yeah. And it hit me. Like, you know, like the bullet that, Colonel Kurtz is afraid to get hit with in the movie Apocalypse Now. You know that silver crystal bullet aimed right for his head? That's what hit me when I realized these people are cheering for guys who are doing Edvard Grieg covers. And they don't even know who Edvard Grieg is, who's the composer where all that music was based on. And I thought, and I'm listening to people shout and scream his name. This has nothing to do with pants coming off your ass and, you know, stylings. This is mostly a, I guess you'd say a kind of a white suburban crowd. And they are cheering for this, and they don't even know who Edvard Grieg is. And he wasn't that great anyway. Edvard Grieg is not the greatest composer in the history of composers. And I thought, this is so stupid and so cheap, and I'm being so manipulated that I just turned it down. I walked away. I mean, I walked out of the concert, and I stopped listening to popular music. I just couldn't handle it anymore. It's just like the, I mean, there's stuff I'd listen to just for fun, like, I love you, she loves me, da na na. You know, that kind of
Barney? Stuff. Was that Barney?
No, it's not Barney. It's like Barney, but rock and roll. I'm not trying to be like the Greek Teletubby here.
Like the old style, like the older, like the bubblegum pop from bubble, like
either whatever it is. And bubblegum pop of 50s and 60s, yeah, or so-called trend-setting stuff today. It's the same thing. It's a bunch of fat guys in a room smoking cigars going, we put this thing with this girl and this sound. You know, it's record producers, okay? That's mm-hmm. what they do. And I just refuse to give my mind to it. Is it? I'm weird, right?
No, I'm virtually the same way. I mean, I listen to popular music.
Yeah, I do. I don't want to put it down.
No, I mean, it's...
The kids like it. Betty likes it. We're in the car. Adele's singing. She has some good pipes.
Sure.
But a guy told me once, who's in the music, I said, man, does she have good pipes? And a guy in the music business said, you know what? There's a million girls with good pipes.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a million good writers. It's the songwriter. Right?
Sure.
So,
yeah. Elton John.
Bernie Taupin.
Yeah, exactly.
Eugene Baby.
Exactly.
Tiny, Rahm Emanuel's theme
Tiny
song.
Dancer. Right? Yes. Oh, yeah. Or Hold Me Closer, Tony Danza.
I always thought that's what you were saying.
You were not alone.
It's a Mondegreen, but I don't know how Mondegreen, how did the phrase Mondegreen work in?
We'll have to look.
That's where you think something is like Hold Me Closer, Tony Danza.
Right.
I can't think of any other ones now, but there's a million of them.
Yeah, oh yeah. Right? I mean, there's just plenty of them. But yeah, I don't know where that phrase comes from. We'll look it up for next week.
Especially with Black Sabbath. If you listen to Black Sabbath, it's really hard to slow it down and concentrate on every word, which is important.
Yeah, right. But don't reverse it because then it becomes satanic, or supposedly.
I saw that band too.
Well, John, Kanye is the least of our troubles for now because he's not running for president until the next cycle. But somebody who's a troubles for us now is Donald Trump. So we should probably bring in.
Why
Tom
is
Bevin.
He? Why Donald Trump is not a problem. Donald Trump is the barbarian, the smelly barbarian that the effete Roman senators are now trying to deal with and trying to snuggle up to. Right, they want to snuggle up to him to see how they can play. This is what I love. Donald Trump is not my cup of tea, but I'm going to ask Tom Bevin questions because I'm writing a column about it. And, you know, one part of the Chicago Way with Cass and Carlin is that you guys get to get an insight into how the column works. Okay, so this is how it works. We're going to call Tom Bevin. He'll be on the air. I'm going to ask him questions. He might say something that would work in a column. And if it does, I'm using it. Speak of the devil, joining us now is one of my friends and the co-founder and publisher of perhaps one of the most important websites in the country, Tom Bevins of Real Clear Politics. Good morning, Tom Bevin.
John Cass, how are you, my friend?
We're good, and we're even better now that the establishment is Republican establishment is wringing its hands in fear and panic. And the Democrats are wondering who's going to have to testify under oath and scuttle Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
So what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I think the Republican establishment, which has been, you know, going through various stages of denial and sort of being dismissive of Trump and assuming that he would fall of his own weight, make some sort of mistake, could never possibly be the nominee, are coming to grips with the very real possibility that he could be the nominee, and it could be over pretty darn soon. I mean, his victory in Nevada was not just a tiny win. I mean, he doubled up. You take Cruz's number and you add it to Rubio's number, and it still didn't match Trump's number. And you look ahead to March 1st, and you know Trump's leading in almost every single state that's on the docket that day, and so he's very well positioned to be the Republican nominee.
For those of you who follow my column, you know that it often appears happily on Real Clear Politics, and I urge everyone, I put it a lot on Facebook and social media, and I urge all of you to do so. Every op-ed columnist and every newsman in the country and woman reads it every day. It has the Real Clear Politics average, which is referred to constantly on cable on the political shows. And I wonder, do you get a percentage every time they say Real Clear Politics?
I wish we did. Right? A penny or a nickel or something.
Some pittance. Well, here's the question.
But we are certainly, you know, we're happy with the visibility and the publicity that our averages get across, you know, during this season. We get, you know, a lot of references, which is nice.
Why is that important? I mean, clearly it's important because you want your product to be known and understood. But for the average political fan and junkie, what does the Real Clear Politics average mean to them?
The whole reason that we invented the average and created the average in the first place some 14 years ago is because we have, you know, polls. We've had a proliferation of polls over the last, you know, decade or so, and oftentimes you will get variant results from them. And I mean, just as one example, we had a Wall Street Journal poll that came out last week. NBC mm-hmm. News, Wall Street Journal, very respected poll, showed Ted Cruz leading Donald Trump.
Cruz 28 surging. To 26, yeah, right.
28 to 26 points. Ted Cruz goes out on national television and said, there's a new leader in the Republican race for president, and it's me.
Right.
Well, that's not true. I mean, Donald Trump, in the last 90 days, there have been 30 national polls taken. Trump's led in 29 of them. He's led by double digits in 25 of them. The polling's pretty consistent on the fact that Donald Trump is the national front runner. And so this one poll result, you know, partisans will grab onto it and use it to try and, you know, make their own headlines, create their own realities. And what the poll average does is doesn't allow that to happen. All the idiosyncrasies of any of these polls, it gives you the best snapshot of time in a period of time of where that race is. And so that's why I think it's important, and it's a good tool for folks who want to follow this race to find out what the trends are, who's trending up, who's trending down, and where the most accurate picture of where a race stands at any given point in time.
What's amazing to me, and you brought it up in the beginning, and I hope the listeners understand that I'll probably be quoting Tom, because this podcast is to let them in on how the column works. And the one thing that I don't think I've been able to quite understand is how the establishment, the Republican side, completely missed the Donald Trump thing. Or did they?
Look, I think certainly the Republican establishment had, you know, the Tea Party was sort of a front runner, a forerunner to mm-hmm. what's going on now. So it's not like this comes completely out of the blue. Yet, I think the establishment thought they certainly underestimated the anger and the anxiety out there and what form it would take, right? To even think that Jeb Bush would be a viable candidate in this atmosphere, I mean, a lot of people saw that one a mile away.
You did. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And you can spend as much money as they want. They spent $130 million and got nowhere with him. So I think they didn't see Donald Trump coming. They didn't see him as the vessel for all this anger. And they looked at him and thought, he's a buffoon, he's a racist, he's a whatever you want to call him. And there's no way that Republicans, no matter how angry they are, would ever, you know, support this guy and rally around this guy. He's not even really a Republican in a lot of respects, right?
Yes,
from a philosophic standpoint.
And historical, right. Historical.
Yeah, exactly. His positions on issues are not traditional Republican issues. But so I think they underestimated Trump's appeal. And certainly, I mean, you've heard these stories. I mean, we've heard them from people in New Hampshire. We've heard them from people in Tennessee and Florida who say, all these Republican, you know, establishment types who say, I don't know a single person who's going to vote for Donald Trump. And yet he, you know, goes out and record turnout and wins these smashing victories. So there certainly is a bit of a bubble effect going on here, even to this very day when these Republican establishment types are looking around. They aren't fully, I think, aware of just, you know, what's going on in the country.
Well, they've played the Hitler card now. I read stuff, you know, people are playing that on him. They play the racist card. The establishment is like using the arrows of the quiver of the left. the character says they should quivers the arrows to try to dent him, and they're not doing it, which brings me to my conspiracy question. You want to hear it? The conspiracy,
sure.
Tom, if there is one, and I don't know really if there is one, is that what they were worried about, the establishment, was a guy like Rand Paul picking up steam, picking up these young voters, and basically realigning the party away from the war party to sort of a traditional conservative with a libertarian slash ethos. And they thought that Rand Paul and that type of thing was the threat. So immediately the foreign policy establishment in Washington, you know, you have the racist card on one side, on the left. The card that the establishment uses is he'll let the terrorists win. So that was the card played on him. Then it was dangerous isolationism. What they thought they could do was let Trump suck up the oxygen from Rand Paul or any of these other rump candidates or outside candidates and then move in with Jeb Bush and his money. And they blew it.
I think that there's a certain, I think, logic to that. And little
Tell
did
me
they
if
know
I'm
they
wearing
end up with
it.
They,
you can say so. We're friends.
No, I look. I think Rand Paul certainly was portrayed, even though he was more mainstream than his father on some of those issues. Was certainly the establishment, in particular the foreign policy establishment folks, attacked him on that. Little did they know they'd end up with a candidate who would stand on a nationally televised stage and say that, you know, George W. Bush lied us into war in Iraq, and that he was responsible for 9/11. And I mean, so they ended up with something a lot worse than a Rand Paul in terms of, you know, but look, that's one of Donald Trump's selling points, is that he is not playing this sort of traditional, certainly on foreign policy, he is not hewing to sort of the traditional stock Republican line. On many other issues as well, but that one is resonating. I think some Republicans, as you call them, members of the quote war party, are shocked by how much that is resonating with Republican voters. That the idea now that the Iraq war was a mistake. I mean, just, you know, a year ago, John, or 15 months ago, or 2 years ago, you know, the line was that Republican that Iraq was a success. It was stable. And Barack Obama was the one who screwed it up by pulling out too early. Now, there may be some truth to that, but
yes.
Certainly now the accepted view is the Iraq war was a mistake, and even a majority of Republicans take that view. And I think that shocks a lot of the folks who supported the Iraq war to begin with.
And it won't shock readers who read the column carefully, because that was the money quote. Thanks. And that's how it works.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, it's Jeff Carlin, Cass's handsome younger counterpart here on the podcast.
Thinner.
Yeah.
Question for you, with everything going the way it is, how does Illinois' primary now be set up for things? Because I know it's people kind of just bypass it, but is it more important this year than previous years?
I think so, just because, you know, the way the calendar is set up, you have all these, I mean, it may not matter if Donald Trump sweeps on Super Tuesday and has a big delegate lead, but certainly a lot of these candidates, you know, Marco Rubio is putting all his chips on winning Florida, which is a winner-take-all state starting in March 15th. John Kasich's doing the same in Ohio. Illinois is going to be a winner-take-all state. Although the most recent poll out, I think, shows Trump ahead by, you know, double digits here in Illinois. So it may not end up mattering. But, yeah, I think it could, in the sense that it is one of those states, decent amount of delegates at stake. It's winner-take-all. And so if the race somehow changes, it could become consequential. But the way things are going right now, you know, Trump's ahead, and he's ahead in Florida. He's ahead in Ohio. He's ahead everywhere, with the possible exception of Texas. He's not leading in Texas, and that's one that Ted Cruz needs to win. But even if Cruz wins that, it may be too little, too late.
What about the other side of this? Now we have Hillary Clinton, who never lied. It tells us she never lied to the American people, and does so with her eyes rolling and her chin bobbing. It's sort of rather serpentine in terms of physically the way she answers things. And then, you know, then she continues it. Bernie Sanders has painted her, I think, quite accurately as the establishment candidate, the true of all of them. She's the true establishment candidate in this race, and she's Wall Street's candidate. How is she going to fare if Jim Comey, the director of the FBI, presents a criminal referral to Barack Obama's likely candidate for the Supreme Court nomination. What happens then, Mr. Bevin?
You know, I think that's the only thing that can really derail her at this point. I mean, I think, she, you know, she's heading into South Carolina. She's got a solid lead there. The cornerstone of her thesis of her campaign is that, you know, African-American voters are going to rally behind her, particularly older female African-Americans. And certainly if she wins Saturday in South Carolina, followed up by on Tuesday with all the southern states that are in play there for her, she will be in a dominant position to be the Democratic nominee. The only thing that's out there that could derail her is this ongoing FBI investigation. And you know, I've talked to some folks about this. John, you've probably talked to some folks about this. There are two things that come to mind, which is, number one, that Jim Comey is an absolute stand-up guy, almost unimpeachable integrity. Everybody I've talked to said he's the real deal. He will go where the facts lead him. He's not going to play politics with this at all. And also that, you know, this is a very serious matter that very well could lead to a request by the FBI or a referral to the Justice Department. And then you're looking at, you know, Loretta Lynch and what would happen there. I think Hillary's going to continue to do what she's doing, which is to say, oh, this is a, you know, all this is like after the fact classification. Right. And, you know,
I didn't know. No one told me it was classified. That's nonsense, as anyone knows who's in the business.
Well, not only that, it's from the folks that I've talked to, lawyers I've talked to about this, it's irrelevant.
Yes.
It's, you know, it's the law does not make any distinctions if you're, you know, receiving. And not only that, we already know, we have an email that's been made public where she's telling one of her subordinates, Jake Sullivan, to strip the markings off of an email and send it to her. So I'm not sure that she's going to be able to get away with that much longer if they do, you know, recommend a criminal charge against her.
But the way to win an election, if you're Bernie, is Sanders, is to go and try to win, to actually attack, not in a crazy way, but to point out that your opponent has serious flaws in these areas. He doesn't seem to want to do that. And from reading Real Clear Politics, I've noticed many op-ed pieces there pointing this out, that he doesn't want to attack her on her vulnerabilities. Why? He doesn't want to win?
I think he didn't think he could win, you know, originally. Now he does want to win. I think he thinks he has a chance at winning. We'll see if he gets more aggressive. But that's a dicey proposition. She is still well respected among Democrats. Democrats don't think the email thing is a big deal. Independents do, Republicans do, the country at large might, but certainly Democrats, they believe Hillary that, A, she didn't do anything wrong, and this is much ado about nothing. So attacking her on it, even if he did go aggressively at it, might not pay dividends for him in the primary. And it's tough. She's a well-respected figure within the party. So, you know, getting after her on that issue, you know, is not necessarily a slam dunk thing for him. So I think that's why he's been sort of tiptoeing around it. And quite honestly, John, I mean, I don't think if she does get indicted and for whatever reason suspends her campaign, or maybe she decides to continue but her numbers tank, I don't know that the establishment is just going to suddenly hop behind Bernie Sanders. I think they would wheel out Joe Biden well before that as an alternative if it came down to that.
I'd love to see Joe. I've already been watching Joe Biden for the last couple of days now on that beautiful interview he did, or statement he made in 1992 about his the president should not nominate someone for the Supreme Court and we should wait for the election. But that's just
yes, me. Democrats have not necessarily helped their case with some of these statements that have come back. But, you know, I still think Joe Biden, he has said that he regrets not running for president. He wishes he could have. It would have been the right, you know, all that stuff. He may still get his chance depending on how this thing shakes out.
Tom, speaking of a Supreme Court, so how do you think this plays out if the president, which it seems like he will, appoints somebody, maybe Loretta Lynch, as John has alluded to, how does that turn out for the general election? I mean, how is that going to be influential?
As a political matter, I think the Republicans are doing exactly the right thing, which is, you know, to just say, listen, no, we're not doing any hearings we're not having any votes, and the next president's going to decide this. I think that's not only a defensible position, it's a smart position. You don't want to have the president nominate someone and say he nominates someone with some centrist credentials, and then to have hearings and, you know, have the sort of kabuki dance where Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, you know, pump this person up and praise them and all that. The story lasts for months. It's better to just say, you know what, nip it in the bud and say, we're not doing this, and forget about it. We'll let the next president decide. Because I think that's a defensible position, particularly because it's Scalia and he's known as a real staunch conservative. If we were talking about Ginsburg and Republicans, that might be seen more as a power play by the public of them trying to influence the shape of the court and all that. But as an election matter, I just think it would be suicidal for Republicans to you know, let Obama appoint someone, take him in there, have hearings, and let this story go on. I think it's much more. I don't think they're going to be hurt because, you know, most general election voters aren't paying attention and aren't going to vote on this issue in particular. And so I just think that this is probably the smart strategic play, and it's not going to have much of an effect one way or the other in November.
I would say that having a kabuki theater in which you know the outcome, the Republicans won't support, the Democrats will shriek, or you could see it in the reverse, right? If it was the other parties involved, I mean, it was flipped, you could see the same thing happening. What that does is undercut the respect for the Supreme Court at a time when the middle or the political center of the Republicans is imploding. The Democrats really haven't really reached that point yet, but those millennials who support Bernie, once they realize that it's already been rigged, the super delegates and Joe Biden moving in or not or whatever, they're going to turn just like the Tea Party people did. And I don't think that it's a good thing for the court in this circumstance to have that kind of kabuki nonsense, but that's just me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's one of those things with, you know, I think, as I said, I just think it's the smart play. And you've seen even folks that, you know, all these folks that are up for re-election, everybody. I mean, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, Ron Johnson was everybody with the exception of Mark Kirk, who's in so much trouble here in Illinois, it's probably not going to matter anyway.
Right.
But I think Republicans have all decided to hang together on this. And, you know, Mitch McConnell came out and just said, it's not a snowball's chance in hell that we're gonna cave in this fight. So I think they're pretty solidly unifying behind this strategy, and that's probably a smart thing to do.
You can read, unless he writes, and he does write often, you can read Real Clear Politics at realclearpolitics.com. You can also hear Tom Bevin's political stylings on WLS on what day, Sunday?
Sunday nights at 8.
Sunday nights at 8 on WLS, which a place I used to know very well. And also on satellite radio, correct?
Yeah, Carl Cannon, our Washington Bureau Chief, he and I co-host a show on Sirius XM, channel 124. It's at 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, so 1 to 2 Central on Tuesdays.
And I've been on that show, and I read Carl Cannon's note that he sends out every morning. Very, very good. And I want to thank you very much for being on the show, Tom.
You bet. Great to be with you, John.
All right, man. You buy lunch next time. You're buying. Remember, we had that deal. All right. See you, man. Thank you.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bone. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
All right, John. So big column this week. Knowing you and knowing how important your religion is to you and how, you know, you feel you have to defend it. Because that's who you are, and that's part of you. You had to write this week, and for those who didn't get a chance to read it, but should have and should, go out and read it. had to read about some unfortunate things that have happened within the Greek Orthodox Church.
Things happen. There are unfortunate things that happen in many faiths, in mm-hmm. many groups.
Sure.
Some that are secular, some that are not. The job of a journalist is to write about them, whether you like it or not, whether you are personally hurt by it or not. You have to. There's a thing, you know, that some people, we don't want to air our dirty laundry. Well, guess what? You're not a propagandist. You're a journalist. What's going on among Greek Orthodox in the Midwest, throughout the Midwest, is that there was a terrible case of a priest named Father Dokos in Milwaukee. He was handed a trust fund to be, you know, run over $1 million. Most of the money went to the church that it was for, but about $100,000 disappeared and went into nice restaurant bills and jewelry for his wife and other luxury goods. So the people started complaining, and the Milwaukee County prosecutor started looking into it up in Milwaukee. And then here in Chicago, because it got hot, the bishop, metropolis here in Chicago, Greek Orthodox Bishop Demetrius, moved him out of there, brought him to Saints Peter and Paul in Glenview. The Church in Annunciation in Milwaukee is a beautiful church. It's one of the Frank Lloyd Wright churches.
No.
Building designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. It's just gorgeous.
He didn't do a lot of churches.
No, he didn't. He did this one. And then St. Peter and Paul in Glenview is one of the most influential Orthodox parishes in the country, wealthy parish. And so what he did was he took the priest that had heat on him, brought him to St. Glenview, and then told the people to like it or lump it.
Chicago way.
The Chicago way. No, it gets Chicago way later.
Oh.
So then they started complaining, and they moved their priest up north. So right now it's just a little priest thing, a priest swap. Why are you writing about it, John? Well, what happened was is that the priest pled, the one from Milwaukee that was brought down here, created all sorts of trouble. And people started complaining. And the parish council started complaining. And the bishop kicked the president of the parish council out of the parish council. And then up there in Milwaukee, they were complaining. And he threatened them to, according to the Milwaukee County prosecutor. And the Milwaukee County prosecutor had to say, stop intimidating people because this is a criminal case. Then he told them, oh, there's nothing wrong with what's going on in Milwaukee. Don't worry about it. He shipped the other priest who was complaining, shipped him all the way out of to exile in Timbuktu. So you had two churches hurting, which is still not a story for most people, mm-hmm. you know, for a column, right? Turns out that the bishop took $6,000 in honorarium from the fellow who the priest who was protesting his innocence, and then just the other day that fellow pled guilty to felony theft. So you have all this strife and anger and an example of how people's faith can be hurt. It's spiritual violence is what it is. It happens in many faiths.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case of, I think in Chicago, of child molestation and some, you know, Orthodox Jewish group, and there was all sorts of complaints about how this was handled, and there's been child molestation in the Greek church too, and of course in the Catholic mm-hmm. church. So you have all these assaults on faith among all these different people, and I've seen others write about their faiths. And I had to write about this one because we go into Lent. We're going into this great season of Lent, and it's a time to prepare yourself. I'm not going to let the corruption of the Pharisees drive me away from thinking about my church, although it's really hard for me. I go to church now, and I just think about all this kind of spiritual violence that was committed on others. I don't even belong to that. My church is Holy Apostles in Westchester. And I just think of the spiritual violence done. And the anger and the lecturing, the hectoring and the gifts and all that. I'm thinking, why don't they just clean this thing up? But they're not. They're not doing it. So what's going to happen? people are going to fall away. The people in Milwaukee, their people fell away. The people in Glenview, they fell away. And we have so much, in our culture that attacks us and brutalizes us, that for some of us, the only place we can find refuge outside of our families is in a house of worship, whether that's a mosque, a church, right? A synagogue, temple. And for me, it's the Greek Orthodox Church. So to have these people play these games is sort of like an assault on that peace. And as we go into the Lenten season, for us, we're ahead of behind on the Catholics in terms of calendar. It's a devastating thing to have to deal with. So, yeah, Betty said, do you really want to write this? And I said, I have to. And I called a good friend of mine, one of the best journalists in Chicago, Dan Michalopoulos.
Good man.
Good man, and he works at the Sun-Times. I said, you know, I call Danny sometimes. I call good friends of mine for consultation sometimes on issues. Like, am I being too personal here?
Mm.
You don't want to be too personal. You don't want to be, you don't want to just carry an agenda, your own personal agenda. You want to hope that you illuminate. And he said, man, Kumbare, go for it. And I did, and he stood up for me on social media. I don't know what the hierarchs are going to say and how they're going to rip on me. The last time I mentioned something about this, there were some priests who went on Facebook and ripped on me. Priests. And I thought, man, this is the Chicago way, isn't it? This
it
is
really
politics,
is.
The Chicago way. So, yeah, it was a tough column. And if you liked it, I hope you liked it. And
it's a good column.
There's others to do. And like we said, when the Tom Bevin thing, that's why I like to do this podcast that you came up with it, Jeff, is to give people an insight into how the column works. And so we give them an insight into exactly what happens. You talk to a guy, he says something that you're thinking about, and you quote it.
It's poignant.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't get the questions from fans this week, John, but we'll get back to it next week. And I know Mutsa, right? It's Mutsa?
It's Mutsa of the month is coming up. And, you know, okay, I'm not going to Mutsa the bishop. I'm just not.
But bad taste.
But the priest might get one. There are many others that deserve it. And I won the Mutsa.
You did.
Last.
You did.
I Mutsa'd myself, didn't
you
I?
You did. You did.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Why didn't you stop me?
Actually, I think that still fell under Will Lee's jurisdiction. He was still in charge.
Yeah. You know what else happens next week is on Monday, there's a big luncheon at the City Club of Chicago. Maybe we'll talk about that next week.
All right, sounds good.
All right. This is John Cass, Jeff Carlin, The Chicago Way on WGN+. Thanks for being with us, and we'll talk again next week.